Oh man, it smells like cat urine real bad. The cat box is in the closet.
Yeah, I remember. It looks like a giant Death Star igloo.
It's like an automated one, but I actually
Looks like
do need
something
to
from the
get.
set of 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah, but it's real nice. I don't have to. I mean, we have three cats. You'd have to clean that shit twice a day.
Yeah, like a normal person. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree.
And in this case, on which movie to see.
Yes. With me again, Keith Foster from San Diego.
What's up? I'm back in the podkizzy. And with me is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Today we're going to be talking about Blindspotting, which I saw. And Mission Impossible Fallout, which you saw.
Yes.
And at the end of the program, for our Netflix homework, we will discuss a futile... What is that movie called?
A Futile and Stupid Gesture.
Which is a Netflix original. Came out earlier this year.
Which we both saw.
Which we both saw. You, I was going to like bring up this whole thing about like how 7-Eleven food is getting like... Like, actually competitive with normal fast food. But then I remembered you went to Comic-Con, so we should probably talk about that for at least a minute.
Yeah. So that's why I couldn't record, is because I couldn't see any new movies last weekend because we were going to Comic-Con. And if anyone's been to Comic-Con, they know it's just like, go, 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 go. You don't really have time unless you like get into a crazy screening or whatever. But so that actually they didn't really have anything like that this year. They did have a screening of Deadpool 2, the super duper fucking cut. And right. But that was it. So this year for Comic-Con was sort of light on the programming. There was no Marvel Studios presence because – you know, they're keeping things pretty hush hush until Captain Marvel. And there was no HBO presence. So it was actually kind of a relaxing Comic-Con, like as relaxing as Comic-Con can be.
Yes.
We didn't have to like camp out for anything because there was like Hall H you could just kind of walk into most days.
This is like the year I should have went.
Yeah, actually, they made a lot of changes that made it pretty relaxed. But I still did get to see some cool stuff. We got to see the cast and Shane Black for the new Predator movie at Conan O'Brien. We saw Conan's taping, and so that was really fun. That I'm excited for that. I got to see the Venom trailer, which just they just dropped today, but so
the
we get
new
to see
Venom
that
trailer,
which I've kind of come around on. I'm not gonna say I'm excited for it, but this looks like Venom at least. Like the other trailers, I was thinking this was gonna be Halle Berry's Catwoman level train wreck. Like it just looked abysmal from the first couple trailers, but now I'm like, okay. I'm starting to be a little more optimistic about it. I'm thinking this might be more in the realm of the Andrew Garfield Spider-Mans.
Yikes.
Which I didn't hate.
Are you sure you're not just drunk on the Comic-Con hype?
I don't think so, but it's possible. I don't know. I didn't really feel that about anything this year. There wasn't anything that I was like, oh damn. But all the stuff that I did see, I was like, So I saw the Bumblebee trailer, the Bumblebee panel.
Okay.
Also, I think they're kind of doing a turnaround on that as well. Director is the guy from Laika.
Laika Animation?
Yeah, yeah. And basically the whole panel, he was throwing some subtle Michael Bay shade. He was just like, you know, Transformers look cool and stuff, but if you don't care about the characters, it kind of just looks like two Radio Shacks in the Kama Sutra.
That's a funny line.
Yeah.
But I'll say that, you know, the teaser that's out there right now, Haley Steinfeld and stuff, when I first saw that there was going to be a Bumblebee movie, I was just like, you know, aggressively didn't care.
Yeah.
And then I saw somebody I kind of trust on Twitter saying, like, you know, there's 2 seconds in the trailer that has more emotion than the rest of the entire franchise.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
yeah,
okay, you tricked me. I'll watch it. So I watched it. And yeah, I mean, basically from the trailer, it looks like the Iron Giant with Bumblebee. And he's an actual Volkswagen.
Yeah, which I think that's it. My biggest beef against it at this point is that it's a prequel. So it's still associated with the Michael Bays. I would have preferred them just sort of do like a soft reboot. But I think that's kind of what they're doing. So
it kind of seems like that's what they could do with it. But I mean, definitely hesitant for sure. But it's a good trailer. I'll say that.
I'm giving it a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt with, you know, a new director, new direction, and the stuff I've seen so far, I'm pretty into. So I'm pretty hyped about that, actually. A lot more than I expected to be.
You were also on the Your Opinion Sucks panel, and not as one of the panelists, but you were, like, led on stage, and they kind of, like, amped up the panel from the times I've seen it. I've seen it at Long Beach Comic Con and over in LA Comic Con. And before, it was just the part at the end, you know, where the people hit the mic and argue with the critics. That used to be the whole panel.
They've added, I think
now there's like a game show aspect to it, kind of.
Yeah. So I think they're trying to pitch it as like a TV show.
That's what it seemed like to me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It looked like a pilot episode.
Exactly. I think that over Comic-Con weekend, they were sort of recording soft pilots. But yeah, I got to play a game with some dude from The Expanse. I don't watch the show, but he was really cool and really nice. And we won. We won our game. Spoilers, I guess.
We posted the episode or whatever you want to call it, panel.
Go watch it on
our Twitter at Jabber Podcast, on Facebook, facebook.com/Jabber Podcast. You can see the whole thing. It's recorded very professionally.
The whole time I was like, I don't know if I want to take my time out of my Comic-Con day to go do this thing. I didn't really know what it was. Mm-hmm. But a friend of the show, Mike Brown, from Gotta Love Them Movies, he was in town for Comic-Con as well, and he did it the day before, and he was like, no, do it. It's really fun, and I'm glad I did. If you get a chance, check it out.
Well, that's cool.
But for the most part, it was kind of an off year for con.
In a good way, it seems like. Maybe. Possibly.
Yeah, it was just relaxed. It was just, I don't know. And I got to do everything I wanted to do, so no complaints at all.
At the top of the show here, we have some movie news. We also have a survey. Let's go ahead and get into the survey now. I posted this a little while ago, and the question is, what single movie have you bought the most times in your life? So whether it be because of format changes or special editions, whatever, whatever, whatever. I'll go through these here, and then we'll say ours at the end. But a friend of the show, Alex Kazia, he says Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Interesting choice. Yeah.
Not everyone says how many times they bought it, but...
Yeah, that's true.
For some people, that is like a favorite all time. That's like, that movie's like comfort food for some people, which is kind of weird to me because I find it sort of difficult. But
I don't think I've ever seen it all the way through.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I've definitely seen enough of it to know it's insane.
Well, you totally. But yeah, you definitely should see it, I would say. Maybe if it ever plays on big screen, like a repertory, that might be the way to catch it, actually. I've always seen it on DVD. Hillary says, some variety of the Holy Trilogy. I'm assuming she's talking about Krzysztof Kieslowski's The Color Trilogy. She's only been released a couple times.
She's talking about Star Wars.
Are you sure?
Yeah, you're doing a bit, and it's a dumb bit. Nobody even knows.
Are you sure it's not Pasolini's Trilogy of Life?
Fuck you. Fuck your fucking face right now. Oh.
Trisha Hall says The Labyrinth. Now, that's one I would expect, for sure.
Yeah.
Because that movie's been out for a long time. It's gone through a lot of formats.
Yeah, and there's been, like... To me, it's the any movie that has like a 25th anniversary, you know, edition. You're going to get like deluxe editions and stuff. And it
right.
probably came out like when DVD first started. And then there was,
I'm sure there was a VHS anniversary
edition and then Blu-ray. And yeah.
I would even extend this question up to, did you have it recorded off TV on VHS?
Ooh, yeah, that I think that counts.
Yeah, sure. Ashley says, not Ashley, your wife, but the other Ashley says, I've bought Moulin Rouge and Romeo plus Juliet twice to upgrade to Blu-ray. So the Baz Luhrmann.
You're gross. It's Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, it's no. It's Romeo. It's Romeo plus Juliet.
Fuck. You're fucking. can we please?
That's how it's spelled on the DVD.
Can because we please get modern. Through this fucking segment?
It's modern.
You're fucking modern fuck.
Brad Page says Ninochka. I think that's
you don't know that one.
I actually don't even know what this is. Now Brad Page is the type of person who would unironically say The Color Trilogy, but he says he bought a VCD from the Philippines a long time ago when it was released on DVD, rebought it, bought it on DVD when it came out in America. Then he bought the Blu-ray, and he also has it on Laserdisc.
Nice. That's my favorite, are the people that are like, the collectors, the ones who are like, I don't even have a Laserdisc player, but I got it on Laserdisc.
I have one Laserdisc, and I bought it on accident because I thought it was a record.
I mean, Brad might have a Laserdisc player. I'm just saying.
No, he probably does. When we were in high school, he had a reel-to-reel, so... But really? Yeah, it was incredible. In his basement. But yeah, I have the Laserdisc of Rock and Roll High School, the Ramones movie, because I thought it was a record. I think I bought it from like Goodwill or something. Chris Fowler says Star Wars.
Yeah, no surprise there.
No surprise there. My cousin Graham says Last of the Mohicans, and that I believe he is all about Last of the Mohicans.
Okay, I mean. Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good movie. I just...
It's some people have their favorite movies. It's not even my favorite Michael Mann movie, but it's a good movie, I guess.
It's not even my favorite Daniel Day-Lewis movie.
And I think there was a couple people who responded on Twitter as well, but I don't have the app open. But I'm pretty sure all those answers on Twitter were Star Wars as well. So that is the takeaway. I've bought Star Wars a few times myself. I actually have the old VHSs with the original covers because I found them at some thrift store or something, and I decided I would buy them just for the novelty of it, especially since I love those old VHS covers. But I also bought them on DVD the first time they were released in the box set, and then I bought them again when they released the two-disc DVD special editions that have the original theatrical cuts. I did not buy the Blu-rays.
No, me neither. Actually, the only time I bought Star Wars was those DVDs with the theatrical cuts.
Yeah? Yeah.
Yeah. That's the only... I mean, I've bought the other Star Wars movies to get on Steelbook, and it honestly pains me. It hurt. It gives me an ulcer that I don't have them on Steelbook. But I don't want the remastered editions. So it's just like...
Yeah. That's why I never bought the Blu-ray. I'm like, surely, especially now that Lucas doesn't own it, they will eventually at some point release everything on Blu-ray.
I was reading something about how, like, now that with the merger with Fox, I don't know what that would have to do with it, but, like, there's now, like, no past distribution license that should be in Disney's way for re-releasing them.
All right.
I don't know. It was a dumb thing I read on the
internet. Yeah. People can only print all the positive things about how, like, Marvel's going to get all their characters back from 20th Century Fox, and now they can start doing X-Men movies again, or now, I guess, something about Star Wars.
Yeah, and there's so much
speculation. They don't talk about the dangers of media consolidation, but, you know.
No. Yeah.
So what about you? What movie, including recorded off TV, have you owned the most?
This is a tricky one for me because I don't upgrade a lot. Like, it's very rare that I will, like, I still have DVDs because I didn't upgrade them all to Blu-ray. Yeah.
I have a lot of DVDs, actually.
Yeah, so I haven't upgraded a lot of movies. I didn't really buy VHSs. Mm-hmm. So I would think that it would have to be something that's on Steelbook. Because those are, like, the few that I have upgraded is, like, to get it on Steelbook. And I think, I'm not positive, but I think the answer, and this might surprise you, maybe not, I don't know, is the 1985 Transformers cartoon movie.
Oh, interesting. So, what, you've had that how many times?
I think three, because I think I had a DVD of it. I definitely rented it enough to where I should have owned it on VHS.
That doesn't count, but okay.
And then I got, like, I think it was, like, the 25th anniversary Blu-ray edition.
Mm-hmm.
And then I recently, I think last year, I got it for Christmas as in Steelbook Blu-ray.
Okay, cool.
So I think three times.
Okay.
And that's a lot for me.
That's pretty good. Yeah. I have here, and I'm pretty sure this is the right answer. I think for me, it's Silence of the Lambs. I used a picture I took of three versions that I currently have in my house. But I bought, and actually one of the versions I owned is not on this picture because I got rid of it already, but I had the original crappy. I think
that's the one you gave to me.
Possibly, if you still have it, yeah.
I think so.
I have the crappy DVD that's in full frame because at a point in time, that was all you could get. Then I have the original Criterion DVD from like the 90s. It's out of print now. And then I bought the 10-year or something. Yeah, I think it was a 10-year anniversary. I bought this more times than I realized. The 10-year anniversary 2-disc DVD, which I don't have anymore because I upgraded to the Blu-ray, which put both discs. I think that's
the one you gave me.
Yeah, probably. Is it white?
I don't remember.
Or I don't remember.
I'd have to go look at my shelf.
It has a lot of special features. It's a good addition. But then they put it all on Blu-ray on one disc, and so I still have that. And then just recently, Criterion re-released it with all of their old special features that were exclusive to the Criterion DVD, as well as the stuff that was on the 10-year anniversary edition and a couple new things that they did. So I've owned that movie five times.
Wow.
Yeah. Without even trying, really.
Would you buy it again?
Never say never.
Like, would again, you upgrade like this to 4K?
No, I don't even have a 4K TV, a 4K yet? Player.
Yet?
Yeah, I mean,
remember when people said this shit about Blu-ray?
Yeah, but I feel like we're already past that precipice. Like, I feel like if 4K was going to happen, it would have already happened.
Okay, well, whatever. You're going to have to wait till, like...
We'll find out.
Red Pie. That'll be the new format.
When we're all playing Red Pies in our bubble tents.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, no, it'll be the VR Silence of the Lambs experience. The augmented Silence of the Lambs reality.
Mm-hmm, where you can be in Buffalo Bill's well.
Just put the fucking lotion on. Oh God, why am I doing this?
All right, let's do some movie news.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
Do we want to start soft? Let's start soft.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is tangentially related to Comic-Con as well. I guess it's not that tangential. They actually announced this at the Sony panel. So they showed the Venom trailer, and they also did an Into the Spider-Verse panel.
Mm-hmm.
And Sony confirmed that John Mulaney is going to be in the movie Into the Spider-Verse, the animated Sony Spider-Man movie, as... That's a drum roll, not knocking. as the Spectacular Spider-Ham.
Finally.
No, there's a story here. So we did, me and my friends, some friends came to town, and we all wanted to do like a big group cosplay. And we decided on like some variation of Spider-Man. So I wore a Spider-Man's costume from the upcoming video game. Our friend Ryan wore Spider-Man Homecoming with like the Letterman jacket. Ashley did Mary Jane as Spinneret. Our friend Natalie did Spider-Gwen. And then our friend Mike, friend of the show, cosplayed as Spider-Ham. And let me tell you, Spider-Ham is motherfucking popular. We couldn't walk more than five. Well, sure. But damn, he is a fan favorite. We couldn't go more than five steps without somebody wanting to get a picture of us, but specifically of him. They thought it was the best.
Did he have a good costume?
Yeah. Yeah. There's pictures on my Instagram. Right. His costume looked really good. But yeah, I am so into this. The footage from this movie looks incredible.
Can you explain to the plebs what Spider-Ham is?
So in comic books, there's the theory of the multiverse exists. So there's different dimensions. Spider-Man is one of those characters where he's so popular. We've seen a lot of different versions of Spider-Man. So there's
sure.
like Spider-Man 2099. There's this alternate universe where Gwen Stacy becomes Spider-Gwen. There's the Ultimate Universe with Miles Morales. He's sort of the focal point of this Spider-Verse movie. There's also a universe where everyone is pigs, like cartoon pigs, and Peter Porker gets bitten by a radioactive spider and becomes the Spectacular Spider-Ham. So he is just like a version of Spider-Man, but with like a, you know, a cartoon pig nose and pig ears.
Yeah. Now is, I've never read Spider-Ham. I've never seen any Spider-Ham materials. Is John Mulaney the obvious choice here?
Yes. This is amazing. Honestly, hearing this after being cosplayed as Spider-Man all day and getting upstaged by fucking Spider-Ham all day was like the cherry on the fucking Comic-Con sundae. It like I lost my shit. I am very excited because I'm a big John Mulaney fan, and I think this is the kind of property that is going to very much benefit from his presence. I didn't realize it's a Phil Lord, Chris Miller project.
Okay, well, I'm infinitely more interested now.
Yeah, I'm super pumped for this.
I would imagine this is going to be animated, possibly.
Yeah, it's full CGI. The artwork is gorgeous. It's a little different than, you know, like a Pixar DreamWorks thing. It's less kiddie. It's meant to, you know, resemble more of a comic book. So I'm excited. I think this is going to be this might be crazy. I'm calling this now. I think this is going to be Spider-Man's Mask of the Phantasm.
Wow. That is even more so than the Miles Morales thing was coming out.
This is the Miles Morales thing.
Oh, this is they're in the same movie?
Yeah, it's all okay. connected. It's called Into the Spider-Verse. Miles Morales is the main Spider-Man. Him and Peter Parker are the main Spider characters. But then there's all these side characters. So Spectacular Spider-Ham is just like a side character in the Spider-Verse.
I have zero idea what this thing is. I thought this whole time, because, you know, the teaser they've released is just a one scene of Miles Morales jumping around on a building and pulling his mask off.
Yeah,
so I thought it was just solely a Miles Morales movie.
No, it's like a crazy, ambitious animated project. I think it's going to be really cool, though.
I hope so.
Again, the footage they showed at Comic-Con, I was very hyped.
All right. Okay, we got one kind of big story, and then we got a really big story we got to cover. But I am a movie pass holder, and I've been saying, and I think everyone's kind of been saying since movie pass started to really pick up subscriptions when they dropped their prices dramatically about a year or so ago, get on this now because it's not going to last. And lo and behold, MoviePass had a really bad week last week when Mission Impossible 6 came out. They officially ran out of money, and now they are $5 million in debt, and they weren't forthcoming about what was going on. They just kept posting things on Twitter saying, sorry, we're having technical difficulties right now. I think they have to take a loan to be able to pay off all the tickets that they can't pay themselves, and then they're going to change their pricing and their rules of the club. So I got an email from them, and I'm going to read it to you now. It says, Dear MoviePass members, first and foremost, I want to personally apologize to each of you for the inconsistencies and unreliability of our service over the past few days. Additionally, I regret our lack of proactive communication with you during this time. We are working hard to improve the communications to our community moving forward. Over the last several days, we've begun making changes to our service that will help us continue to offer our members high-value, low-cost in-theater movie experience. In order to continue growing our service and maintaining a high level of financial discipline, we need to make some modifications. Bullet points. We must reduce availability for big new release titles such as Mission Impossible Fallout and other popular new releases. At least for a while as we adjust. At least for a little while as we adjust the business model. We're working on making this more clear in the app so you know which titles are available. Showtimes that are offered through our service will vary from day to day, and every showtime may not be available. We encourage you to check the MoviePass app for showtimes before you leave for the theater. While our customer service team has made great strides as of late, we still have a long way to go to provide the most responsive customer service experience for you. In the meantime, access to immediate support may become limited. However, we are working to prioritize the requests of members who are at the theater and introduce more self-help tools, as well as focus on resources on fixing glitches and bugs in the app. Finally, we want to be as transparent as we can with these changes and any future changes. We are committed to giving you the best experience. We count on your support and loyalty while we implement these necessary steps for the company you've grown to love. Thank you for your understanding and patience, and we'll be in touch with more updates as we have them. Mitch Lowe, CEO of MoviePass.
So, MoviePass is done.
Yeah, however, I will say this. Everyone's been saying MoviePass is done for a really long time.
Yeah.
Every time they have to make one of these kind of seismic changes in the pass. And I'll say the one thing that MoviePass has going for it is how popular it got as fast as it got. Like, when I stand in line for a movie...
Yeah, but it got that way because it was fucking...
An impossible model. Yeah. It was an impossible model to sustain. And I'm sure they thought at some point they could. I don't know what they thought, to be totally honest. They were just paying for all these movies for people. But, you know, I think the thing that they have going for them, the one advantage, it's probably the only reason why they're not totally filing for something right now, is that they have an incredibly large subscriber base. So it's now at this point, it's just about maintaining that subscriber base, which it sounds like they're not going to do.
No, it sounds like, I mean, it might become like a fringe thing, but I think it's like on its last legs. I think this is, I mean, they've changed their format. They changed their pricing so much. They've been so inconsistent. I mean, this was exactly why I didn't ever get MoviePass, because I just kind of didn't trust it. And, I guess it does. At the end of the day, if it just stops working, it doesn't really affect me that much. Mm-hmm. But I have a feeling like somehow their subscribers are going to end up on the hook for something. I don't know. It just seems like,
I don't think so. I mean, they might raise prices, but at that point, everyone will just unsubscribe.
Well, they're already raising prices. They're already raising prices and cutting movie availability to the movies people want to see. So I just, I don't think it's going to last much longer.
No, I don't think so either. But there is the Movie Pass effect, which is all of the major chains like AMC and Cinemark have kind of created their little version of MoviePass to compete while MoviePass was doing really well. Mm-hmm. So if they stay in business, or if they're able to kind of tweak their models, we still come out, the consumer still comes out with better pricing per movie, or, you know, at least some variety of plans. It's kind of like the movie Obamacare. It's not perfect. It's not what we really want, but it's better than it used to be.
Yeah. I mean, I guess. Sure. I guess. I think MoviePass itself is going to be done soon,
though. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Now we got to get into it.
The elephant in the.
The major elephant in the room. This happened over Comic-Con weekend, actually. Director James Gunn, who directed the first two Guardians of the Galaxy films. Okay, he got into some hot water on Twitter, where a bunch of old tweets of his were unearthed by a right-wing extremist named Mike Cernovich, who has a hard-on for getting people fired by finding old tweets of theirs and then, sending them to their employers. Largely because James Gunn was vocally against the current administration, among other things. There are a lot of crass, blue, dark humor jokes about, a lot of jokes about pedophilia, a lot of jokes about rape and incest and these types of things. Long before he ever knew he would ever be able to make a Disney movie. We're talking, you know, some of these date as far back as 2009 to about 2011 or so, as well as some old blogs of his and stuff that were probably dug up in the Wayback Machine or something like that. Disney fired him, and now there is been a outcry by a lot of people online to rehire him, to bring him back, since these tweets that he made were made before he was hired in the first place. Surely Disney had some sort of vetting process. They definitely knew those existed. And some have mentioned that his blogs or something to that effect were addressed before he took the job for the first Guardians of the Galaxy, in which he already apologized, already said he's moving forward from that, not going to be doing that kind of stuff anymore, hasn't. And now there's even an open letter by the cast of the Guardians of the Galaxy saying that they stand with James Gunn, and as well as a moveon.org or change.org petition that the last time I saw had over 300,000 signatures on it. So, yeah, what do you have to say about all this?
I have a lot to say that I've been saying for the past week and a half.
Right.
Okay. First of all, and I've read a lot of like people's arguments and talking points about all of this on both sides. And there are,
It's not a cut and dry issue.
It's not. I understand to an extent Disney's position. Mm-hmm. They have always positioned themselves as a family company, mm-hmm. And stuff, especially regarding children, I get why they're gonna be sensitive towards that and react to that. On one level of a business decision, I can kind of I understand how that seemed like the immediate right answer.
Mm-hmm. To just put as much distance between them and it as possible.
Yes. I think that in this particular case, they made absolutely the wrong call at the wrong time for all the wrong reasons.
Agreed.
I think instead of it coming across as we want to distance ourselves from this controversy, it comes across as pandering to a right-wing doxing fucking troll monster who also all the people who immediately want to take Michael Cernovich's side in all this has tweeted just as offensive things.
Let's not conflate the two.
Sure. Yeah, you're right.
James Gunn tweeted juvenile dark humor jokes that I don't think are funny. And I would say that's the worst thing about them is not that not how dark they are, but just how not that funny they are, really, to be honest. Especially from a professional screenwriter.
Yes. But Michael Cernovich tweeting things he believes.
He's actually tweeting talking points. And let's give people a little bit of background on this character here. Okay, because I think this is the big part of the story when this broke that nobody was talking about.
Yes.
All you heard was...
And I think that it is very important to the story.
It's the major part of the story. Michael Cernovich made his name in the Gamergate controversies in whatever it was, 2011. And then shortly thereafter, he became a well-known figure within the men's rights activists. The red pill Reddit community and that kind of stuff. He was something of like a professional pickup artist. He wrote blogs and stuff about how he invented all the stuff about like the beta males and the cucks and all of that. All that language kind of comes from that sort of world. And this is when he tweeted things very seriously in no joking manner, not with no irony, things like, rape culture does not exist, or it's date rape, can't happen because, I can't remember the exact wording, but something in the effect of like, try and force yourself on somebody. It's harder than you think. Date rape does not exist. Like these are things he actually believes. And then he became a correspondent for Alex Jones on InfoWars, where he helped propagate the Pizzagate hysteria, which led to an actual person attacking a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. with a gun because he was convinced because of this insane story they cooked up on Alex Jones' bullshit website that there was a pedophile ring underneath the pizza parlor because of some vague mentions about getting pizza in the John Podesta emails during the DNC leak.
So for all of you who are still listening,
mm-hmm.
who we didn't lose because now we're full political commentary, here's the thing. Michael Cernovich is a piece of shit.
I think you can say that without even having a political opinion about him.
He's
not a real political person, really. He's just a leech himself to whatever little internet movement is happening on the right or on the extreme right. Now he claims that he's alt-right, but before he was just a Gamergate troll.
So yeah, so he digs up these tweets, and again, relevant to this story, it looks like the optics on this from are so bad. It looks like Disney is caving. It is totally caving to the pressure. They're giving this guy exactly what he wants. Now it has spiraled so far out of Disney's control because. There are people radically upset on both sides. There are people saying that they think that James Gunn is a literal pedophile because of jokes that he made. And here's the thing. I'm glad you did make that distinction, because they are jokes. Here's the thing. I don't know James Gunn personally, but from everything I do know about him, I haven't seen a single shred of credible evidence to show that this indicates any type of person he is. Right. These are, and so there are some people out there right now that are like, all jokes are based in truth. Okay, as a comedian, that is 100% horseshit.
Not and it all also depends, jokes are based in truth. It also depends on the type of joke that it is. And we should I should also say that James Gunn is not his only target. He's done this to a lot of left-wing commentators and news people. He's, you know, very unfriendly to the media.
Week and a half that this has happened, a lot of comedians now, so not even a bit more of an obscure director, comedians now are trying to be doxxed for their old jokes and their old stuff, which, again, you might not think is funny. And that's fine. That's fine that you don't think it's funny. And does Disney have the right to fire James Gunn? Yes, of course they do.
This is not a free speech issue.
It's not. Yeah. It's not. Disney 100% has the right to fire him. But was it right to fire him? I sort of understand why they felt like they needed to get ahead of this. Mm-hmm. But really what they did was just make the situation so much worse.
Right.
They've opened the door to every doxer and attempted blackmailer to try and ruin the credibility of anybody who has made any kind of comments, which 5 years ago weren't even that out of fashion.
No, I would say that, and this, you know, this goes into the greater kind of conversation of, like, is dark humor even a thing anymore? You know, there was one really good tweet or response to this that somebody said that I agreed with. It said, you know, basically all of the jokes that he put are like the same things you would see on Family Guy. Like, yeah, they have
or
that, like,
South Park.
Or South Park. Or like a lot of things. Yeah, they had that creepy pedophile character on Family Guy who could have said the exact things that he was being tweeted in an ironic tone.
They were presented as though they were truths and not someone trying to get a rise out of people.
Yeah. And he says himself that at the time he thought of himself as sort of a provocateur. And that's the other thing I was going to say is that a lot of people I don't think know who James Gunn is, like as a director and where he comes from. James Gunn comes from the world of Troma.
Yes.
Troma Films, which is a low budget, usually direct to VHS, exploitation, house that made movies that, like Toxic Avenger, which was what they're mostly well known for, but that's actually one of the tamer things that's come out of them. But it's a lot of stuff that's purposefully in bad taste and has a lot of gore and nudity and juvenile humor. And that's Troma. That's the world he came from. And that's why his movies, you know, and I would say including the Guardians movies to a certain extent, have a certain kind of edgy sensibility.
Yeah.
He graduated from that and he made movies like Slither and Super and The Specials, which was kind of like Guardians before Guardians.
Kind of.
And you see that evolution of, like, you know, and some people have said this and I tend to agree. You can take the man out of Troma, but you can't take the Troma out of the man.
Yeah, I can see that. So here's the other thing. There's also been a lot of comparisons to James Gunn getting fired for these old tweets, to Roseanne getting fired for her tweet, which, I think there's an important distinction.
Not the same, yeah.
Not the same at all. Roseanne was tweeting racist things, seemed very unaware that it was racist,
yeah.
Was surprised when she got fired for being openly racist, and then gave a ham-fisted apology in a desperate attempt to get her job back, which didn't work. And then she rescinded her apology.
Yes.
So James Gunn gets fired for these old tweets that are more than a decade old, which, by the way, people are conflating it on Twitter. So these tweets are 10 plus years old, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And that has already spun to he's tweeted 10,000 tweets about pedophilia, which isn't true. He has not tweeted 10,000 tweets. There were a few. I'm not going to lie about that.
Yeah, there were a lot. But, if you comb through somebody's entire Twitter history and just looking for one specific kind of joke, you could string together what looks to be like a lot of one type of joke.
Sure. And here's the other thing. If there was any indication, if there were anything saying that any of this had any bearing on James Gunn as a person, mm-hmm. I would totally understand.
Immediately. And when the story first dropped and I read the details and I saw Mike Cernovich was involved, which I knew before I even read it, I said, you know what? I don't want to say anything right now. I don't even want to respond to anybody online. No. I'm going to wait at least a week, because if there is anything at all and based in anything in this, Me Too era, somebody's going to step forward. And possibly multiple people will step forward, which
yes.
has not happened. In fact, if anything,
the opposite has happened.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the stars of this, franchise. Mm-hmm. Sticking their necks out for him.
Including Chris Pratt, who is low-key, super religious in real life.
Yeah. Yeah, and they also waited a week to see if anything further would develop. And exactly. You're going to tell me that Disney wasn't digging into that more than just a little bit? Which is why they should have not done things the way they did. It's so insane. But... whatever. Right. Again, back to my original point. There's a difference between someone who tweets something hateful, doesn't realize it's hateful, and barely apologizes for it, and then recants that apology, and then someone who already apologized for this behavior, said he's going to change, and has in fact demonstrated that he's not tweeting humor like this anymore. He hasn't since he started working for Disney. He's towed the company line. He's kept his image clean. So I think it is at this point, again, unless there's some kind of new information that comes out, which I would have to hear from a fucking credible source.
Right.
It's bullshit. It's bullshit. And I think Disney made the absolutely wrong decision. I think they're feeling the pressure of that now. I think they're kind of in a damned if they do, damned if they don't situation.
Yeah. It's kind of fucked up for them, because even as just like a clean business decision of like, hey, we're going to do this. But here's the real here. I mean, like, if we're being real, they don't have that much to lose, because they could throw Adam McKay or somebody like that onto the new Guardians, or Taika Waititi, sure. who would fit in pretty well with that aesthetic. And people are going to go see it regardless. And this story will have been a year plus old, mm-hmm. and people don't have that. It's not like they fired like Joss Whedon or somebody like that, who people genuinely know and have a lot of affinity for. I think a lot of people are hearing the name James Gunn for the first time now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say the people who are the most upset about this are probably the people like us who kind of knew who he was before the Guardians movies.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes, there might be some people who are upset about this, but ultimately, I don't see them changing their position from this.
I hope they do, but unless
the cast stands up and says, we're not doing it. Unless he's back. That's the only thing I could see them changing their mind on.
I don't know. When this first happened, I totally agree with you. And I agree with all your points as well. I think it just depends on how Disney wants to try to spin it. I think if they do reinstate him, they are going to be real careful before they do.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. It is a little weird that so a lot of people are pointing to the fact that it's weird that Disney hasn't said anything after all this pressure. And that is strange. That is a weird thing to do. And I I don't think it's completely unreasonable. Like, you know, AMC just reinstated Chris Hardwick after his whole controversy. They kind of had a knee-jerk reaction. And I don't want to get into that too much. It just, to me, that one literally devolves down to a case of he said, she said.
Right.
And I'm not saying if I'm pro Chris Hardwick one way or the other, but there is a precedent there.
Yeah, this wouldn't be the first time. And this wouldn't even be the first time in which it was a Mike Cernovich target that got fired and then rehired.
Yeah, so
I mean, the same thing happened to Sam Seder. He was a commentator on MSNBC, and one of his jokes were taken in bad faith, and then the backlash of his firing was like so extreme that they hired him back within a week.
Sure, and I think, yeah. I think with pressure from the movie stars, especially Dave Bautista has been very vocal about
very
it.
Very vocal, yes.
With pressure from the news outlets, you know, a lot of people are publishing very unflattering articles about how Disney made the wrong decision and stuff. So
yeah,
there's pressure. If the pressure stays on, you know, again, I think either way, you're going to have people unhappy with Guardians 3. Yeah. So I think it just kind of depends on the image they want to set themselves going forward. So I see it most likely sticking, but if it doesn't, I'll be happy. Again,
they could also just be waiting for this to blow over, too.
It's true. It's entirely true. So here's the thing. At the end of the day, unless there's some actual credible evidence that this might be based in reality somewhat, which I don't think it is, it's going to be really hard for me to watch the next Guardians of the Galaxy movie under these circumstances. I think of the idea of them bringing in someone like Peyton Reed to direct Guardians of the Galaxy, and it makes me sick. Because I think Guardians is my favorite franchise of the MCU, probably. And a big part of that is because of the personal connection with the director and the cast and the crew. And so it's for me as a movie fan, it's really hard for me to see somebody else complete his vision, because it was supposed to be this trilogy. And especially the circumstances with which everything went down. I'm a comedian. I've said shit that wasn't funny in the past. Hopefully not on Twitter. I don't know. I've made sketches that now would be offensive. So it's really hard for me to not see his side of things. It's really hard for me to not be like, I've said shit just as bad, you know, in private conversations, joking around with friends.
Sure.
You know, would I say it now? No, I actually think
that his apology was I understand the position he's coming from, and like, obviously he doesn't want to burn bridges and stuff, and mm-hmm. he doesn't want to make the situation any worse for him. But I actually think that his apology is a little too kind of tail between the legs. If I was him, I'd be like, yeah, I don't think this is very funny anymore, but you know, fuck it. It was a joke. Get over it.
Yeah, but he seems, No, I agree. But I think the fact that he hasn't, I don't know.
I think it was Jeselnik, the comedian.
Yeah, someone tried to do the same thing to him, and he said, trying to find offensive jokes on my timeline is like trying to find a needle in a needle store.
Yeah, a needle in a needle store on free customer appreciation day or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, but Anthony Jeselnik is absolutely, like, his brand is 100%
offensive humor. You know, yeah,
spinning something so it's the most offensive possible. Right. So
that's that. We'll see how that develops, and we'll keep it updated as it goes on. But let's start reviewing some movies.
Yeah.
I'm going to start here. I'm going to start here with Blindspotting, which I caught over the last weekend. The last episode we did was for the indie film Sorry to Bother You, which I reviewed with my friends Amanda and Katie.
I know. I still haven't seen it either, and I
you
really gotsta. Want to.
You gotsta.
I want to. I haven't had time.
There's so many movies right now. Okay, so, and Blindspotting is the other film. The other Oakland film that was filmed almost, I think, simultaneously around the same time. Both sets were going. And this is also another indie film. This is directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada. And if I'm not mistaken, this is, looks to be pretty much his first feature. And it stars David Diggs and Rafael Cassell as two friends. They are professional movers in the city of Oakland. They've lived there their whole lives, but they're living within a specific borough or district that's being gentrified by Google and Amazon and all of the Silicon Valley techies who are now crossing the bridge, you know, from the Bay into Oakland and sort of pricing everybody out. Around this time, our lead character, played by Diggs, Colin, he had recently gotten into some legal trouble where he got in a bar fight that spun out of control with a hipster who called him a name or something like that. And now he has to kind of be careful and make sure that he can keep a job and all of these things. And he's trying to sort of redeem himself from that, while his best friend, Miles, is a little bit more of a loose cannon. He has a lot to prove. He carries a gun with him, even though he doesn't really need a gun with him. But he's one of those kind of people who has a lot of bravado and likes to walk the walk and talk the talk like he's really tough. This character is white, and David Diggs' character, Colin, is not. But their friendship goes back to middle school. They've pretty much known each other forever. You know, they use the N-word for each other in a sort of loving, brotherly way. And that's just sort of the dynamic of the relationship. Diggs is also trying to kind of woo his ex-girlfriend back, who sort of put some distance between them once he got into his legal trouble. So it's sort of just about his day-to-day life. He witnesses, early on in the film, he witnesses a police shooting. This shooting and sort of the case behind it is sort of plays out in the background of the film as he's just trying to sort of continue on. And it sort of follows these two characters and their sort of journey of reconciling where they are in terms of the city of Oakland as it stands now with this gentrification. So it has thematically a lot of similar things going on to Sorry to Bother You. Sorry to Bother You takes all of these themes and plays them out in this sort of absurdist, almost sort of magic realist sort of way. This movie stays a lot more kind of grounded and realistic to a certain extent. Although I will say this movie is sort of a musical, and they don't really say that in the trailer. And It's not a musical in the sense that, like, you know, they don't like stop in the middle of conversation and then, you know, a big swell of like strings and horns comes behind them and they start dancing and singing in the streets. But they kind of have a slight version of that, where in the middle of conversation, the two characters will start talking in rhyme, and then it'll actually kind of create like in what seems improvised, but then obviously not improvised, little rap sequences in the movie. In dialogue kind of flows in and out of these during different points of the movie, placed about where you would place them in a traditional musical. So I don't think everyone would call this movie a musical, but I kind of think it's a musical somewhere in the DNA of what's going on here.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. The performances all the way around, especially by the two leads, are really, really good. I love their friendship. In a way, I said this is almost kind of feels like could be this generation's Clerks, because they have that kind of like Dante Randall chemistry in the movie. and the way that the movie's largely based on conversation set pieces and that kind of stuff. A lot of walk and talk scenes, or them in their moving truck just kind of talking to each other and bullshitting and that kind of stuff. But then it has, you know, a larger kind of socio-political context, which it feels kind of lazy to say because I said the same thing about last week's movie, but it's true here. There's obviously the presence of Spike Lee very heavily on this movie.
That makes sense.
And a lot of Do the Right Thing. And both movies, both Sorry to Bother You and this, are very audaciously shot and stylized. You know, Boots Riley's magic realist sort of Michel Gondry stuff is very different from what's going on here, but there's a lot of really cool tracking shots, a lot of very stylized and moody lighting, and the movie has a look, and that was one of the things I really liked about it, is that it's not a movie that just by the screenplay would necessarily need a lot of style, but it has a really cool kind of sensibility to it, and it's shot with a lot of confidence and subtlety when it needs it. And it's also really funny. There's like, you know, five or six great comedic set pieces that are placed in the movie, and a lot of really funny back and forth and dialogue. And it kind of had that kind of Clerks-ish vibe in that sense, too. It's a really great problem to have that I can't decide which one of these movies I like more because they're both really strong and they're doing very, very similar things, but in very, very different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I give this movie an A. It's probably going to end up in my top 10, if not 5.
Oh, wow. All right.
Yeah. Blind Spotting.
I hadn't even heard of this movie. So when you told me to go see it, I was like, fuck you. I've never heard of it. I don't know anything about it. I just want some good old fashioned like movie escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to see, you know, the popular movie coming out. also, it's better for the clickbait, Cassidy. Think of the podcast. So I saw Mission Impossible Fallout. This is the sixth installment in the Mission Impossiverse.
I think it's just a traditional sequel, but okay.
No, I think there's a rule that, like, once you get past 5, it's like it's
now a movie universe.
So this is the return of Christopher McQuarrie as the director. He directed the previous installment, Rogue Nation.
Was that the name of the last one?
It was Rogue Nation, and then before that was Ghost Protocol.
You're right.
That was the one Brad Bird did, right?
Yes.
And then it was, before that was Mission Impossible 3, before that was Mission Impossible 2, which doesn't really count, and before that was Mission Impossible, which also doesn't really count. I mean, they kept the character's name, but Mission Impossible 3 was basically a total reboot. So, synopsis. Ethan Hunt is alerted to this mission where the guy he brought down in the previous movie, his like criminal syndicate has sort of scattered to the wind and gotten their hands on 3 nukes. And at the beginning of the movie, he's trying to set up a buy to buy these nukes, and things go sort of awry, and he has to make a choice between sort of his teammates or recovering these nukes. He chooses his teammates, and the nukes go out in the wind. So basically the rest of the movie is about him making up for his mistake and trying to make sure that, you know, these nukes or whatever.
Right.
Because of this, they introduced a new character played by Henry Cavill, who's a CIA operative. And basically he's there to make sure that they're doing their jobs right and they're recovering these nukes. And that if they don't, he is, you know, authorized to get them back for the CIA by whatever means necessary. So there's a sort of added pressure of he's got sort of like this government babysitter watching him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a spy movie and there's twists and turns and action.
Double crosses, triple crosses.
Yeah, things like that.
Yeah,
I'm never excited for a Mission Impossible movie. I'm never just like, oh, I can't wait till that comes out. But I always enjoy them. And this one's no exception. I saw it had like an absurdly high Rotten Tomato score. I had like a 98%. I was like, hot damn.
Yeah, they've been doing pretty well for the last few, but yeah.
Yeah, pretty much since 3. They've been on a pretty good track record. So I was invested enough. I do think there's some clunkier moments in this one, though, than the previous ones have had. Like, there's very, like, trailer-y moments, if you know what I mean. Like, there's those lines that they obviously were setting up to take out of context to get people to watch the movie.
Yeah. Like, just a moment that's going to look cool in a trailer. Like, somebody's going to turn around and talk at the camera and say a one-liner or something like that.
Yeah, like when Ving Rhames is like, Ethan, that's not who we are. Well, maybe we should reconsider. And, you know, it's one of those moments that's like, they play it very differently in the movie than the trailer, but they...
Right.
There's some good stuff here. I really like Henry Cavill's addition to... Mm-hmm. The Mission Impossible universe, like I really like his dynamic with Tom Cruise, even though it sort of surprises me that Tom Cruise allowed Henry Cavill to do this movie because he's a giant mountain of a man. And there's like scenes when they're kind of walking together and you really realize how short Tom Cruise is. And I know that's like something that he usually...
But they're kind of playing up to that, right? Because there's, like, these fight scenes that you see in the trailer where you can definitely tell, like, they're kind of playing Cavill up as, like, this big hulking beef.
Yeah. Like, he's basically a hired hitman. You know, he's sort of, like, a rougher, kind of dumber version of the Daniel Craig version of James Bond. He's like very physical, and he's kind of a doof. And I really liked his character a lot. My biggest complaint about this movie is I think it kind of treads along Spectre territory of relying on the past movies a little too much.
Yeah.
One of the fun things about these movies is they're summer serialized blockbusters.
Yeah.
So for the most part, they're pretty independent of each other. But this one like required me to do some digging in my memory brain of like, oh, who was she? I thought she was dead. What? Okay. Oh, so this was probably the bad guy from the last one. I don't remember him being so bad. I don't know. It sort of hinges on the other ones a little bit more. And I think to the movie's detriment, I mean, for the most part, it's still pretty much a standalone adventure. Like you can see it without remembering all that past stuff. Cause I didn't. Mm-hmm. And you're still going to enjoy it. I just think there was just a little too much of it, especially near the end. There's some details that they force me to remember from, I think, Mission Impossible 3. And I was like, this is asking a lot.
Well, how are the stunts? Because that's what, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, with the Mission Impossible films.
Sure.
The first three or so are, like, legitimate spy movies. Where they're mostly about, like, intrigue and double cross. And, like, they're a lot more concerned about the plot. And then from Ghost Protocol on, it starts to become a little bit more like the Fast and Furious movies, where now they're just kind of stunt porn, which is fine. I enjoy stunt porn, and that's the same reason why I enjoy the Fast and Furious movies. I don't remember anything from movie to movie when it comes to plot and characters and who lived and who died and like, you know, who the bad guy was in the last movie. I don't give a shit. They pretty much all run together in my head. But you watch them for the big stunts.
I think the Fast and Furious analogy is really appropriate, especially for this movie. I think this sort of feels the most Fast and Furious of them. Like there's an extended set piece in there's like a really cool car chase. I mean, here you're not going to be disappointed. The action's insane, of course. My only real complaint is some of the actual set pieces feel a little familiar. Whereas like in the past, I think specifically Ghost Protocol, like there's that extended chase scene in, is it Dubai? With like the dust storm.
Yeah, yeah. And
that one was like really different and creative. So this one I think is treading the most familiar ground. Like there's a chase scene in Rome that reminded me so much of Spectre that I was like I was getting James Bond flashbacks.
Sure.
And so they did them really well though. So it's really well done action sequences set in very sort of familiar settings. You know, like there's a crazy helicopter chase over some mountain range, but it's sort of indistinguishable from any kind of those movies. I would say that this is, for the Mission Impossible franchise, this is somewhere between their Skyfall and their Spectre.
Okay. So it's not your favorite, but you enjoyed it enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd give it a solid B.
All right.
You're gonna get your oohs and your ahs, your thrills and your chills.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, I looked up all the Rotten Tomato scores on the other Mission Impossible movies. Mm-hmm. I keep in mind the first few existed before the website existed, so I don't know if this is like the best aggregate, but
sure.
The first one has a 63%, which is lower than I would have thought. The second one has a 57%, which is the only rotten score. The third one has a 70%, which again is lower than I would have thought.
Yeah, because I think that's sort of a watershed moment for them.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess people just weren't. Well, maybe that was also at the height of like Tom Cruise's crazy.
Yeah, that's true.
Ghost Protocol has a 93%, and Rogue Nation has a 93%, and this last one has a 97%.
Yeah, see, I think that's a little high.
I think it's because people's expectations have lowered. I think they're like, oh, this is stunt porn. So let's stop pretending like we are paying attention or care about anything about the plot. We're just watching this for thrills.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's fun. It's fun. It's fun as hell. And like I said, it's worth watching just to see Henry Cavill's arms. Jesus Christ. He is, like I said, I'm surprised that Tom Cruise would allow a younger, much hotter, much larger man to sort of
to play opposite him. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
But there are definite scenes where like women are like overly complimenting Tom Cruise. So I wonder if that was kind of to make up for it.
Maybe. Let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework then. A Futile and Stupid Gesture, which you had me watch. This is directed by David Wayne, which I didn't know until actually I looked it up afterwards. But David Wayne, being the director who he worked on The State, the MTV sketch comedy show, and then later did
that
like
that makes a lot of sense.
Well, there's a lot of State guys in here, but he also did Wet Hot American Summer and Role Models and a lot of other movies. This is a biopic about the creation of the National Lampoon. And we did a documentary in our Netflix homework about this not very long ago. I think probably within the year, right?
I think it was about a year ago.
Yeah. And this covers the same story about the people who started it, Doug Kenny and Henry Beard, who met in Harvard. They're played by Will Forte and Domhnall Gleeson. And, you know, they're sort of the class clowns at their Harvard. They join the Harvard Lampoon and decide when they graduate college that they want to continue on with the comedy thing instead of becoming lawyers or whatever they're supposed to do after Harvard. And so they get somebody to fund them, and they change comedy forever with their brand of irreverent and socially conscious comedy. This becomes, you know, popular, becomes a radio show, which then kind of spins off into movies and tangentially Saturday Night Live and all that other stuff. The difference between the documentary and this biopic is I think this focuses a lot more on Doug Kenny as a character and kind of centralizes on him as sort of this troubled figure who's obviously using humor as a way to sort of deflect his insecurities about his father and other things. And, you know, all of this craziness and drug taking and his sort of irreverence towards society as a whole has a lot to do with him not feeling like he belongs in society. So I think that's the big difference between this, the more bird's eye approach of the documentary and this biopic. But what did you think?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think so. A couple things. It was nice having seen the documentary, so I sort of knew the beats. Like I knew because they don't really focus a whole lot on the like the magazine and stuff itself.
Not really. They mostly montage through that.
Yeah. So it was nice to have that background information, but I also wasn't a huge fan of that documentary. Like as a documentary goes, it sort of lingered on all of that stuff a little too much. So it was nice to have that background, but I don't know. I think it's just easier to watch a story with a character. And I think Will Forte, even though he's playing it very Will Forte, I think he fits the role pretty well, and he's sort of this charming goofball who, even when he's behaving very badly, you can see how people can forgive him. Yeah, I don't know. I enjoyed. There were some interesting directorial choices, which I appreciated. Like, it could have been a very by-the-numbers sort of rise-and-fall story.
Yeah.
But, there were some interesting, like, stunt casting interesting sort of framing device that, to me, I don't know, really humanized the story in a way that worked. I mean, you know, it's not a perfect movie, but, you know, I thought a lot of it was pretty funny, funnier than the National Lampoon actually usually was. Like the magazine itself was, I don't know.
Right. I kind of agree with that.
I will say that some of the stunt, like some of the casting threw me off a little bit, like the guy who played John Belushi. I've seen him in a couple things. And he did it, to me, it was more like they were trying to capture the essence of that person than trying to.
Well, he's a very peripheral character, thankfully, because I agree the person just isn't like great for the role. But I will say that
Joe McHale
as Chevy Chase was pretty much spot on.
Yeah,
kind of. Definitely, I would say. And not just because it's a good impression, but also like. It's an informed impression because he worked with him.
Yeah, that personal history is there, and
I
liked it because it doesn't feel like it's an impression. It feels like it's an interpretation. Like they don't really try to make him not look like Joe McHale. Mm-hmm. I think there's even sort of a fourth wall breaking moment where one of them says something about that.
There's a lot of asides. There's a lot of kind of like Annie Hall-isms in this movie, or a lot of Goodfellas-isms in this movie, as far as like breaking the fourth wall or stuff they do with narration and stuff like that, which some of that kind of stylized stuff I think can be a little obnoxious from time to time. But
in this specific movie or in movies in general?
Sometimes movies in general, but specifically in this movie. Okay. There's some times when they're like being a little too cute or a little too clever for their own good. But I will say that the thing that I'm glad that they tried to do, and having David Wayne come in as a director, and obviously it's written pretty well too. But I think that the thing that they did that I think makes this more than just like a rise and fall kind of historical biopic is that they bothered to make it funny.
Yeah.
And they put a lot of, especially in the dialogue, it's very dry, it's very quick. The interactions between Domhnall Gleeson and Will Forte, especially, they're very, very practiced. And that's my kind of comedy. I really like really, really kind of dialogue that you can tell, just like they know the person's line before they even have to say it.
Yeah.
And the
witty repartees,
yeah,
and
yeah, very quick. Mm-hmm. And I will say that almost clangs a little bit too much with the more serious sort of domestic stuff that kind of comes in and out of the movie. And I can't say that I was always into that.
I will say, I think the flaw of this movie is they make Doug a little too likable. Like I think that maybe they should have showed the consequences of his bad behavior be actual consequences a little bit more.
Yeah.
But it was sort of like, you know, he can cheat on his wife and it's just like, oh, well. And there are moments where I think that plays better than others. Like there, when he breaks up with his wife, I thought it was really cool how they did it in like the old Lampoon comic strip style.
Right. And that's actually one of those kind of Annie Hall-ism sort of style asides that could have been annoying. But I actually thought that they really handled that well, because rather than having to actually do that whole scene, which would have just been like any other like breakup scene you've seen 1,000 times in a movie, it actually like does it really nice, really quickly, and sort of in a poetic way.
Yeah, and it creates one of the film's only sort of somber moments. And I think maybe, you know, near the end of it, because I think the ending is pretty abrupt.
Starts to wind down by the third act, and that's my issue with it, I think, ultimately, is like the movie's so light and fun and kind of and quick and witty and all of this stuff, and then the movie sort of remembers like, oh yeah, we kind of got to tell a story. And so when they get to that stuff, they don't feel like as excited to get to that stuff. So instead of it like having any dramatic impact, it just kind of feels like the movie's winding down.
Yes, yeah. And that's my big complaint with it too. But for the most part, I actually enjoyed this more than a lot of like the Netflix originals.
Yeah, same here.
Because I felt like they, even though, because I do agree that the story kind of just peters out and the end just sort of happens. But even though that's the case, it feels like they actually want to tell this story and they actually want to do it with some creativity, and they don't want it to just be sort of a paint by numbers project, which it easily could have been.
Yeah.
I'd recommend it. If you are a fan of, you know, the old National Lampoon stuff. Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely, less worthwhile stuff to watch on Netflix than this.
Yeah, it's totally watchable. I'd say it's fairly entertaining. It's pretty funny. If you're a fan of, you know, any of the people involved in this movie or comedy history, if you're a comedy nerd, that kind of stuff, there'll be things in here that you're excited by or that you like. I can't say that it's like an impressive movie really on any level. Like it's just about as good as it has to be. but
I think it's a little better than it has to be. I think it could. I think it could have been a lot more generic than it was. Like I
agree with that. I would say that a movie that does kind of this, but better, and maybe with a little bit more style, and I think it lasts a little longer in the grand scheme of, like, you know, like cinema history or whatever, is something like American Splendor. This movie reminded me a great deal of that in some regards. But I like this movie too. It's fine. I give it like, yeah, it's like a B minus.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair.
All right. Well, the Netflix homework I'm going to assign you, and it'll be whenever the next time you're on. I know that you have to take next weekend off for your anniversary. But the next movie we'll be talking about in the Netflix homework, tell me if you've seen this one, because we didn't discuss this. Gone Baby Gone. This is Ben Affleck's directorial debut.
Oh, I haven't. No.
Then we'll be doing that one. And yeah, that's the episode. If anybody has anything to say to us as far as the topics that we brought up on this episode, including the movie news and the movie reviews, Comic-Con, all of the above, you can get in contact with us on or at our email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can find us on Twitter at jabberpodcast. And you can find us on Instagram at Jabber Podcast, which we should, both of us, especially you, when you were gallivanting in Comic-Con, should have been posting more on our Instagram page.
I kind of hate all social media right now.
I know.
I don't know. Instagram's one of the good ones so far, but
So follow us there, do all of that. You can follow me individually at VC Cassidy, and you can read my reviews that I post on my personal blog at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, as well as some of the content I've provided for the Seattle-based website, mcguff.in/author/Cassidy is my page. So, what else? Is that pretty much it? What do you want to promote?
We just wrapped up book club, comic book for Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. We did a superhero story that was fun. The next month or so, we're going to be doing improvised Shakespeare. So if you have any interest in that, come check that out. But other than that, no, I don't really have anything to plug. You can follow me at Keith Foster Kid on all the socials, and check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com.
The other podcasts that you should be listening to that include Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, Rod and Denise / Rod and Moksha over at The Listening Party, Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought, and Bill and Brian over at The Great Albums Podcast, and Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places.
Yeah, check out Adam Connie and the Adamant Podcast. Check out Marilyn Bowe at Campfire Shit Show.
All right. And that's the episode.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to end this podcast.